Can you hear me now? I think you can. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the second in our series on food security. Last week, we got to look at the connection between equity and food security. Today, we're going to look at the connection between, among three things: food security, sustainable agriculture, and climate. Before we welcome our speaker, Dan Dalton, please pray with me. God of us all, we are grateful to be able to gather together and learn more about the work to which you have called us. You have given us many jobs to do, and one of those is to learn to take care of this beautiful earth in a way that feeds all of us now and in the future. So bless us as we learn together, and bless Dan as he teaches us. And we ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen. So today is our guest, Dan Dalton, who's part of, there's a lot of long terms in here, so I'll try to get them all right. Anyway, he is part of the Pennsylvania Sustainable Agriculture, where he serves as the Associate Director for Farmer Training and Development. He's also part of the Pittsburgh Food Policy Council. He's a board member there. Education-wise, he holds a master's degree from Pitt in international development with a major in development planning and environmental sustainability. He's worked as an agronomist, which is advising farmers how to manage their soils sustainably, as a vegetable grower, and as an educator teaching agroecology. So today we're going to learn from Dan. Please welcome him.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I want to thank you all for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here and give me a nice opportunity to sort of pull some thoughts together on this topic. I feel like in my work, we just sort of assume a lot of this, or we've all experienced this. So it's nice to sort of go back to roots and sort of build it out. So I'm happy to share with y'all. I wanted to start off with just getting a sense for who's here. Did anybody grow up on a farm or farm adjacent in your youth? Is anybody currently or recently subscribed to a CSA program through a farm? Okay. Gardeners who are active or past gardeners? Okay. And is anybody a member of PASA, my association, or ever been to any of our events? All right, cool. So you're all new. Great. That's good to know. Clean slate. That's good. I'm happy to start at zero. So my association, we were originally called the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, which is 17 or 18 syllables, and that's a lot. So we mostly go by PASA. We are a statewide organization. We're a nonprofit. We are based around our farmer members. So we were actually, before we were an organization, we were founded as a conference in 1992, where a group of sustainable and organic farmers who didn't feel like they were having their needs met through the normal farm education networks and extension and all of that actually got together to teach each other. And so that's sort of the grounding ethos of our association, is peer-to-peer sharing, learning, and education. So as a staff person, I exist mostly as a catalyst to sort of set the stage for our farmer members to do and share, you know, what they've learned and what works for them with other growers. After that first conference, there was still the interest in more opportunities in season. You know, farmers have a very narrow window of time where they're available to get together. Usually that's in the deep winter in February around here, but they still wanted to get together throughout the rest of the year. So our organization exists to provide workshops, webinars, trainings, opportunities for learning throughout the whole year. More recently, then, we've expanded into a couple of other areas that we think are really important for supporting farmers. The first is farmer training programs, actually giving folks an opportunity to explore careers in agriculture and move toward them in a structured way, because a lot of the normal ways that folks would have gotten into ag careers have really broken down. People aren't getting their first jobs on farms. People aren't farm adjacent as much anymore. So these are opportunities for people to learn in a structured way, things like dairy grazing management, diversified vegetable management. And right now we're actually also working on an agroforestry program, which if you aren't familiar with agroforestry, it's this broad umbrella of practices that really, I think, is gonna be really important in light of all the climate changes that are coming our way. And I could talk a little bit more about those in a little bit, but we're trying to basically train the next generation of agroforesters as well. We also expanded into on-farm research, which is new. And it's a little bit different from traditional academic research, where in that setting, you would have a thesis, you'd have a managing professor or researcher or whatever, who would be testing their hypothesis out in the world. X leads to Y, yes or no. Ours is actually sort of grassroots, ground up benchmark research, which is that we just collect a whole lot of data from all of the participants about everything they do related to the topic. And then over time, we build up a base of information that we then can compare against the cohort and see what's working and what isn't. So it's very slow, it's expensive, and it requires a level of commitment from our growers that isn't normal for traditional research. But once you develop that base of knowledge, you're able to actually parse differences over time in a really meaningful way, because it's actually, again, the farmers revealing to each other what they do and what works, rather than some academic's idea somewhere else. So the buy-in is a lot higher, the results are a lot more meaningful. So one example of that, does everybody remember 2018 and how wet it was? Some of us do, if you were paying attention. We had about 200% our normal precipitation in 2018. So in our study, we'd been running about 3 years at that point, and we basically could observe, we had a good baseline of what people's soil health looked like across a whole wide range of measures. And with that rain in 2018, we could actually watch across the entire state of Pennsylvania, all cohorts, all production styles, all farm types, a drop in soil health across every producer in the state as a result of just being waterlogged and all of the attendant challenges there. Subsequently, then we're able to watch 2019 and 2020. Did the farms recover? To what extent? So in 2019, we come back and look at the next year, which was slightly droughty. It was a little bit on the dry side. We didn't get 100% recovery. We got about 50% recovery. And then in 2020, we got about another 20% recovery. So you think about a single year shock like 2018, it's going to take us multiple years to get back to what the baseline was as of 2017. And so insights like that are things that we're trying to then reflect back to farmers, where they get the whole cohort, they see everyone's anonymized data, they get to see their own farm's data, and then they get to see what their peers' data looks like. And they can make decisions based on all of that. And we feel like it's really powerful, and is going to be more so in the future as we go forward, to have this base of data when we test against really hot years, really chalky years. And, you know, if we have a more profound drought like we did this year, 5 weeks with no rain, what are the effects? What are the ways that we can react? How can we manage more sustainably? We also have a financial benchmark study for vegetable farms, where we are looking at, again, their finances and what works and what doesn't. And I'll talk a little bit more about the results there, but that's really important for growers who are first generation growers, where they don't have a parent or a previous generation to tell them what's normal or what's good or what's not good, and where traditional extension services aren't supporting them in the way that they used to. To have the insights of their peers and to compare themselves to themselves and see, you know, are they making a profit? Are they being sustainable financially? And what is the way forward? What sort of tools do they have to improve upon that? We completed about 2 years ago, a livestock productivity study where we looked at a lot of times when you look at confinement animal livestock operations, they talk about how efficient they are. And that's one of the, you know, it's cheap and it's efficient. It's also really abusive. It's also really polluting, but they're able to draw the boundaries around those systems in such a way that they exclude all the negative externalities, all the pollution, all of the harm that they do, and just focus very narrowly on the economics and the space use. And so we undertook for a couple of years a study to see, is that actually true? Are they actually more productive just on those parameters, and to compare them with pasture livestock products? And what we found is not really. They're no more efficient once you start accounting for all of the externalities that they're involved in than their pastured folks. And in that case, then you've eliminated both the pollution and the animal cruelty. And so you can have the exact same product. Actually, it's actually healthier in terms of the meat and all of that, but you can have comparable products with none of the harm. So we've concluded that study now, but the information is out there for anybody who's interested. And then the last of the studies in the benchmark series is about nutrient density and looking at what actually is making it into the crops in terms of their healthfulness. So you can have good nutritious soil, but if your plants are unhealthy, they're not able to uptake, assimilate, and process those nutrients into an actual healthy, productive, nutritious crop. And so we're looking at then comparing those. Farms already have to be a participant in the soil health study. They join on additionally to the nutrient density study, and then we can compare those results and say, here's what's in your soil. Is it making it into your crops? And if not, what is that gap there? And how can we provide technical assistance for folks to grow a more nutritious crop? And again, that'll come back later in my comments. We also have received a couple of very large grants. One to provide COVID-related farm worker relief to farm and food workers related to 2020 and 2021 COVID. Basically, all of the relief programs carved out farm workers. And so a lot of the checks that were sent out to support people explicitly excluded farm workers, food and food workers. And so we received the because of our connections directly to farmers, received a USDA grant to pass along grant checks to them to make up for that gap and that deficit. So we have a multilingual team that goes out right now all around the Northeast and sets up shop and actually accepts applications, processes payments, and then gives the farm and food workers the payments in whatever form they're able to accept. Because again, many of them are unbanked as well. So you have to find a mechanism to get them cash that they can actually use without giving cash, because you're not allowed to give cash. So you have to find something that's cash adjacent, as you can imagine. We also, smaller grant to do direct outreach to traditionally underserved communities. The USDA realizes that they have a real problem in terms of accessing underserved and historically marginalized communities, and also that they don't really have the bandwidth necessarily or the expertise to reform that. So we are serving that function in terms of reaching out to historically underserved and marginalized growers to involve them both in our work as well as getting them connected with USDA services that they are qualified to participate in. And then the big one, and this is going to tie into the second part of this, is a Climate Smart Commodities Grant, which is we're the lead partner on a multi-state grant, 15 states from Maine to South Carolina, and we are the lead, to explore over the next 5 years climate-related practices for growers, both to help them adapt and mitigate climate change and climate-related impacts on farming, and then to present back to the farming community which of those practices are worth pursuing and funding in subsequent years after the grant. So it's part research, it's part implementation, it's part education. And we think that that's going to be really impactful too. I'll pause there. So anybody have any questions on the background? Sure.
Yeah. So it sounds like you have the leading edge knowledge about these topics mm-hmm. for this area, mm-hmm. right? And what portion of the people that do this work, farmers, gardeners, whatever, participate in contributing to and accessing that knowledge?
Yeah, it's really hard to say because the gardener, homestead, startup farmer cohort is sometimes a little reluctant to engage. So they might be doing practices or they might be attending workshops and not actually giving us active feedback in terms of what they're learning and how they're
what is your guess?
I'll give one caveat and then I'll try to give an answer to that. It really depends if you're talking about like percentage in terms of area or percentage in terms of number of participants or active growers and all of that, because we've got a lot of small growers sort of in a patchwork constellation around. We also have a couple of really huge growers who cover a lot of area in a single farm or farm entity. I would say that just based on, even in the conventional world, the way that thinking has evolved over the last 10 to 15 years, I'd say that, you know, 60 to 75% of growers are incorporating some amount of this into their work. It's how actively they're engaged varies quite a bit, though.
And is there a lot of data collaboration across the country?
Yeah, we work through partnership agreements. So it's how we accomplish a lot of our benchmark research is through partnering with other peer organizations. Where it's appropriate, we also partner with Extension or, you know, other, you know, more conventionally minded producer associations and all of that. So, yeah, I would say that there's a lot more collaboration in the last 10 years than there was in the previous 40 or 50. I think people are realizing that there's sort of becoming this convergence around at least the understanding of soil management, pest management, and the climate implications, such that people are willing to collaborate a little bit more. Yeah. Right. Yeah. As the climate situation intensifies and deteriorates, yeah, it becomes more important. Yeah. Another question? Yeah.
Looking back in history, it seems like the founders of our nation had little awareness of environmental issues, the fact that we have only one earth and we have to take care of it. So there's nothing that I know of in the Constitution that impels us to do the things we need to do. And my question is, now that the gun is at our head because of the disasters that some people like yourself can see coming and others don't, are we too far gone to have effective legal protection for the earth, to have statutes that impel the government to provide things that farmers need and things like that? So where are we in the legal field?
Goodness. So my partner is an attorney, and I should say that I probably shouldn't opine on the law. I'm going to touch on some policy stuff if we have some time at the end, but just to say that I think that there is a need for recognition that these impacts cross political boundaries, and that whether that be through, you know, legislation or, you know, legal precedent or something like that, I think that this fiction that the pollution from Eastern Ohio power plants doesn't somehow impact Western Pennsylvania is really silly. And the same with you know, all of the greenhouse gases, and the same with, you know, these extreme weather events, the wildfires in Canada, things like that. So I think that the actual mechanism to get there is probably beyond the scope of my work, but to say that I think continuing to highlight the need and the realities, just that their boundaries, you know, the climate doesn't respect these boundaries, and that we need to create a framework or engage across them. Similarly, just to understand the magnitude of different inputs that are driving this, you know, transportation and agricultural degradation being two of the foremost in terms of contributing to climate. You know, I have no impact on the transportation space, but in the agriculture space, I think that there are a lot of levers yet to be pulled and to be activated through policy and through incentives and all of that, that can be a major contributor to the solution. So.
Again, I'm not real familiar with your organization, but I, in my previous career, I banked companies like some of the large chemical companies that mm-hmm. were doing genetically modified and plant, you know, drought resistant plants and things. Is that a totally different approach? Are you the organic approach, or do you two step in lockstep and accept some of those ways of approaching it?
Yeah, I mean, we explicitly don't have organic in our name or in our mandate. We try to have a broad tent for practices, both to have people be involved and to be able to pursue the solutions that are sensible. The challenge I think that we have found when you zoom out a little bit beyond the GMO crops themselves and the chemical inputs that go with them is that it's a really fragile system in and of itself. Like it requires, you know, ongoing glyphosate use, for example, or it requires heavier equipment, or, you know, it necessitates certain things that, you know, our members sort of choose whether or not to engage with. In that regard, I will say in the soil health study, we have a sub cohort of conventional no-till growers. So for those who aren't savvy on all the boundaries there, those would be conventionally minded growers who are using herbicides and heavy equipment, but they are still really concerned about soil health in their practice. So they make sure that there's never a day without living or some sort of organic cover on their ground. So it's possible to do that in a conventional way as well, through herbicide and through GMO seed and through heavier equipment. It's really interesting to see, you know, here's this sort of other breakout group that's really interested in the same thing we are, but has a different set of tools that they're bringing to bear on it. We also see through the benchmark study that there seems to be a very narrow band that they exist within. So that soil health study is on a scale of 1 to 100. And it's normalized for your soil type. So it's a pretty fair assessment. All of those conventional no-till people are banded together around 70%. So they're better than average, but they don't seem to be able to break out and get beyond, you know, 65 to 70 on a scale of 100. And we're trying to figure out with them in collaboration, is there something that they could be doing? Is it the herbicide? Is it the heavy equipment? Is it something else in their system that keeps them above average, but still well below their potential in terms of their soils? So I think it does take all types. I also think that within the climate change adaptation space, and I have this in my notes, but I'll give you a preview already, is that, you know, within things like seeds and seed varieties, you know, we've lost a lot of seed diversity and across, you know, regional diversity, ethnic diversity, various utility diversity that was there and has been lost through commercialization. And those old sort of strategies for growers in the north versus growers in the south, mitigating hot, humid climates versus, you know, short season with extremes, is the kind of thing that we need to move back to. We need to reclaim some of that genetic past, whether through its through breeding or through actually, you know, resurrecting old varieties, so that we have varieties that can respond to, you know, really short seasons, really extreme heat, high moisture, high disease pressure, things like that. So it is going to be sort of, we're going to have as many tools in the toolbox in response to climate as we can. I do want to sort of touch back to how I think about sustainable agriculture, just to be a little bit of grounding before we jump forward. And it's really important, I think, to keep in mind, I haven't found anything better than the triple bottom line approach that folks might be familiar with, but that's basically economic, environmental, and social sustainability in balance and in relationship to each other. I think a lot of times traditional, more conventional growers really focus on economic sustainability before anything else. You have to make a profit to be sustainable to continue. And that's true. I think a lot of the organic and sustainable growers, you know, really focus and have an intuitive sense for the environmental sustainability element, erosion, eutrophication, diversity, all of that kind of stuff in the crop space, but then sometimes lose sight of the economics. And I think everyone is falling short on the social sustainability element of it across the board.
Is that because we don't know how?
how to be socially sustainable. Okay.
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question was, is the lack of social sustainability a lack of knowing how to get there? I think that it's basically that we expect farmers as independent operators to accept all the risk and bear the brunt of all of the sort of stresses and whatnot. There's very little support. I mean, we think about crop subsidies and things like that, but they don't apply to most growers, especially to fresh market, you know, food crop growers. They apply to corn and beans and rice and commodity crops. So in a year like this, where, you know, you have a cold snap and you lose all of your blueberries to the cold snap, that blueberry grower just eats all that cost and puts their hope on next year. This happened last year where almost all of New Jersey's blueberries were wiped out in one cold snap last year, which is really good for Pennsylvania's blueberry growers, but doesn't do anything for the Jersey berry growers. And then the sort of sad irony is that the next year, the plant now has more energy. So there's more fruits. So you end up with a fruit glut. So now you get a lower price next year. And there ends up being like one bad snap ends up being sort of a 2 to 4 year recovery period. It's especially true in fruiting species. Think about all of our fruit growers in Adams County. The same thing happens there. One of our members told me that they expect to get a plum crop 1 out of every 5 years because Adams County is so shocky. Sometimes it's too hot, they don't pollinate. Sometimes it's too cold and the buds freeze off. The price is still there, that 1 out of 5 years still pays for itself. But there's a very real possibility that like Pennsylvania doesn't grow plums in the future because there's just, you know.
So it might be an argument to make, whether it's true in the absolute or not. It might be true in the practical sense that sustainability is in the eye of the beholder. For me, good prices on the blueberries is perfectly sustainable. For the farmer that's not making a buck, that's unsustainable.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things, especially for first generation growers, is again, not having that legacy of prices and budgets and, you know, support getting in, is that they don't often know their costs of production. And so what that means is you go to market and you're a price taker. What does a bushel or what does a bundle of carrots go for at the market? And if you don't know your cost of production and you're charging $5 because everyone else charges $5, but it was a $7 bunch of carrots for you to grow, you've just lost $2. And it takes a lot of confidence to be able to like look your consumers in the eye and say, this is a $7 bunch of carrots. And I know that my neighbor, my peer farmer, it's $5, but do they know their cost of production? Maybe we're all just price takers, you know, at a certain point. Yeah.
But given all of this adversity, mm-hmm. What in the world draws people into this world?
Yeah. It's a great question. I think for a lot of folks, it's the opportunity to reconnect with land in a way that they find. Many of our growers are second career folks. They go out and they try something corporate. They go out and try something that seems lucrative. Maybe they even make a bunch of money, but they've always sort of harbor a passion or an interest in agriculture. I think that the connection with the earth really drives a lot of folks to be out there doing it. I think it's also an opportunity to be actively engaged in some of this work around climate and the environment, to go out and plant, hundreds, thousands of trees, to be able to treat animals the way that you feel they should be treated, and to, you know, sort of live your values in that way. I think some have, you know, sort of a service mindset, service to their customers or service to their wider community, that agriculture can be service as well.
A philanthropic dimension.
To some extent. And I think that harkens back to some of our older, you know, approach to community in terms of, you know, community service and, however you define your community and however you engage with it. I think farmers often are drawn to that. Yeah.
I hate to say this, but when you look at the island of Manhattan, it's sinking into the ocean.
Sure.
It tells you a lot about what we really care about.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And I think that the social elements around, and the economics too, of farming is such that, you know, we've come to this place of disconnection. You know, 80%+ of the population is urban. You know, we go to the, you know, milk comes from the grocery store, greens come from the grocery store. Maybe we go to a farmer's market, maybe we have a CSA. We don't do a lot to maintain that relationship with food production, even rural communities, you know, getting out and understanding what's driving and what's concerning. You know, there's a significant rural communities here in Allegheny County, like, and we don't connect with them nearly as much as we might. And there's a, you know, there's a lot of anxiety there. There's a lot of hardship in those spaces. You know, most of our, you know, food insecurity is in rural areas. And it's important to remember that.
To Dan's question, I can't resist saying, why are we all here in this chapel? And that is because of a basic human need to find meaning. You know, once you have a roof and health and food, what's next? It's meaning. And we're here seeking meaning. And farmers, I think, find meaning in their work.
Yeah,
absolutely. As we all do.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are, you know, there are folks who are out there as, you know, educators and liaisons. You know, when we put together our vegetable program, one of the metrics we used was how many other points of connection did folks have to each other? And so we had one farmer who had basically a 50-year farming career and had turned out more than 50 farmers himself as apprentices and interns and employees and students. So basically more than one a year. He had trained up new farmers that had gone out around the world, you know, Africa and around the US and Canada and Mexico. And many of them are also sort of paying it forward into the ag economy and training, you know, future producers without any real compensation or consideration for that fact.
So is the population of farmers growing?
Is the population of farmers growing? I think the rate of decline is slowing down, right? Some of that has to do with, you know, the age of the existing farmer cohort, just aging out basically. But there is a influx of new interests and new growers coming on. It's not enough yet to balance out those who are exiting. But we hope that through this constellation of service, we're able to provide people pathways in. Because for as many people as are actively pursuing or engaged as new and beginning growers, there are 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 times as many who are harboring an interest in those things, but can't see a way in because of the, you know, the land access, capital access, knowledge hoarding, you know, student debt, things like that. All of these things that are drags on people's ability to engage. So one other thing that I want to sort of break out and then I'll keep moving is that within the social realm, you know, we think about people and people relationships there, but I also want to sort of carve out like a little subset there, which is the question about whether the social relationships that are going on there between farmers and employees, farmers and customers, customers and the wider ag community. I think we think about humanity and whether practices are humane in relation to animals and animal cruelty. But I think that there's a lot of trauma being passed along and passed back and forth within the human relationships in the food system too. And it's really important to ask whether the systems that we're creating and perpetuating and the practices that we're supporting are humane for everyone across that spectrum, whether they're ethical, and then also whether they're culturally appropriate, because there are differences in culture, many overlapping cultures there. And if we are forcing people to engage with a culture that doesn't conform or doesn't speak to them, that I think we're doing a bit of violence there too. Question?
Yeah, I think actually that I'm going back to an earlier part of your discussion, but I'm wondering about what happens to the soil How is it different? If I, like, for example, in my garden, I just pile leaves on, mm-hmm. and that's our fertilizer, yeah. and I get good results. But if somebody doesn't have that, if they go to the Home Depot and buy the jug of whatever mm-hmm. and put that on, and maybe their tomatoes are as big as mine, but does that do something different to the soil?
Yeah, I mean, it, yeah, anchoring back to like soil organic matter, which is a hub around what which a lot of this revolves in terms of soil and crop production and all of that, you know, adding organic material back to the soil is one of the things that has been lost as a part of our process as we've sort of disintegrated our ag systems. So right now we've got a lot of space in the city that is actually prime and quite good for urban agriculture. And yet we send all of our wood chips to Ohio to be composted or burned. And it's like, well, you have this great organic input and you have this soil that needs organic matter. Couldn't we find a way to put these two things together and move forward? So in your case, you're talking about leaves and other organics that you're putting in. Yeah, I mean, you're basically building up, you know, your soils, you're sort of, it's a way to feed the soil. Fertilizers, I'm assuming that something in a jug means fertilizer. You're going to feed the crop specifically, and you're going to get a bigger crop. You'll probably get more yield and all of that. There's a question about how nutritious that is relative to something that's grown in a very healthy soil. You know, we can debate that, or we could actually look at the lab analysis if you want. But it's sort of two different mindsets, right? There's this sort of sufficiency, like what does it take? What's the minimum to grow a crop and a good bumper crop? And what is needed to build a robust ecosystem to support a crop? And that sort of has been the historical tension in, you know, what we would call, you know, organics and sustainable and all that, you would call that alternative agriculture, even though that's sort of the historic way that it would have been done pre-World War II, and then sort of mainstream, which is like, let's just do the math to figure out the minimum.
My impression is that across the whole country, mm-hmm. corporate farming produces the most food. Is that true?
I would say probably, yeah, in terms of volume, yeah.
And do you have any connection to any of those folks? Do they take advantage of your knowledge?
Do they take advantage of our knowledge? If they do, I don't know about it. I mean, it's like I said, at a certain point when you scale up, certain realities become obscured or things, you know. So when you're talking about thousands or tens of thousands of acres at a time, you know, the fertility realities, the equipment realities, the production and processing realities are so divorced from what small and medium-sized local diversified growers are engaged with that it becomes sort of apples and oranges.
It's a different business.
It's a different kind of business. Yeah. And you know, in that case, that's where, you know, you're trading on hedges, and there's all this sort of market trading that's going on, and there's the insurance products, crop insurance and all of that, because it is fundamentally a commodity. It's a capital C commodity at that point, and you kind of have to treat it a little bit differently. Yeah. To the sort of ecosystem benefits and all of that, with your question about organic matter and all of that, is like, that's one of the ways we see forward in terms of climate, is basically taking all of this carbon that we've taken from, you know, coal seams, gas veins, all of that, and put up into the air, bringing it back in and sequestering it in the soil in the form of soil organic matter. And so, you know, it's the kind of thing where you can see a visual difference when you look at high organic matter soils and low organic matter soils. It gets darker. It gets more friable. The texture becomes easier to work and all of that. There is an actual physical and colorimetric difference. It's tough though, because it's the carbon cycle, right? You know, it's going into the ground, it's going up into the plants, it's going back into the air, and you're sort of cycling that carbon there. So you're only capturing, you know, a 10th to 1% of any carbon that you put into the ground. Most of those leaves that you put in are going to get broken down by organisms and respirated back up into the atmosphere. So it's this constant process where we need to be creating and recreating the carbon cycle that we've sort of disrupted by taking it from below in the subterranean areas and put up, and now we have to be putting it into the shallow spaces of the soil and elsewhere. But like I said, there's this disconnection already where we have these highly degraded soils. We've got all this strip ground in Pennsylvania that was taken for coal that needs remediated and could be productive with the addition and the management of organic matter. These urban soils, again, that are just heavily compacted and devoid of organic matter. It doesn't take that much. We decompact it, we start cultivating it with organic matter, and it moves forward and becomes productive. And that's true across the spectrum. I think with the heat that we've had recently and the heat that we're expecting to continue, you know, things like productive green space are a way to mitigate the heat island effect. You know, you think about the difference between the city and, I don't know how it is here, I was in the North Hills on Thursday. They have a 2-week difference between West Deer Township and East Liberty. That is the heat island effect manifests. It's all the concrete, it's all the buildings, it's all the asphalt just accumulating and holding on to heat. So you're flowering in East Liberty. The season is two weeks offset. Yeah. It's 2 weeks longer in the spring and it's 2 weeks later in the fall. Now, for our urban growers, that's a competitive advantage. They have a month of extra growing time that they can capitalize upon potentially. It also means that there's a lot of particulate matter blowing around. There's a lot of excess heat injury. There's a lot of just public health implication to communities that are excessively hot and hold on to and radiate back heat. It means that your air conditioning costs are higher, you know, all of those things as a result. So having green space, having well-managed space can be a really good mitigation for that, in addition to providing, pollinator service, habitat. Green space, we know, drives economic value for homes. So by remediating and developing and providing green space, you actually increase the economic value of communities. There's a lot of benefits to be had there. All right. I started off with like a rough outline and ended with 5 pages of notes. So I don't know actually where I am at this point. In terms of thinking about the climate a little bit, I mentioned the way that ag is related to it. There are these sort of overlapping drivers. You know, one of the biggest in terms of pushing a lot of carbon back into the atmosphere is tillage. Every time you go through and you break up your soil, you basically break some of the, you know, the root bonds, the mycorrhizal fungi bonds and all of that, and they respirate back into the air. And that's a release. So if you see some of the charts of CO2 emissions, they basically track with every spring when we cultivate, ping, and they ping, because, you know, you release a whole bunch and then much of it gets sequestered back down into the plants that we grow, and then we release more. Right. And so, not to say that tillage needs to be eliminated, because there are challenges there too, but to understand that aggressive, deep, constant tillage is a driver here. And if we can find ways to address that, I think we can find a way forward. Like I said, you're basically breaking up and burning up your organic matter. Soils around here, just for reference, you know, usually historically would have sat at about 3 to 5% organic matter. They can hold 7 to 8% reasonably. Most of them are at 0.5 to 1.5%. So you think about the gap between 1.5% and let's say 7, that's all of that is organic matter that can be captured. That's carbon that we put in the soils and hold there. A lot of our policies are encouraging, you know, basically planting fence row to fence row. So as you're driving out in the hinterlands, as you're up in Butler County and elsewhere, notice that there are no windbreaks, or there's very few, that there's no buffers, there's no hedgerows, you know, the sort of things that you would have thought as historically. And that was from policies in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, basically saying, tear those out and plant corn all the way up to the road. And what does that mean? It means that when we get a major rain like we've had, there goes your soil. Also, there goes your nutrients. You know, I'm out in Indiana and they do this deep drainage, these tiles. And they put the ammonia fertilizer on and it goes right through the soil profile and right into the rivers. And they're basically lucky if they capture, you know, some percent of that. And that's all because of, you know, economic incentives and extension support and training, the way that we've trained farmers to grow over the last 50 years. and it doesn't have to be that way. Also, you know, as you need to be thinking about and encouraging folks to be thinking about risk management. Like I said, you know, to lose your topsoil in a major rain event because you don't have buffers, because you don't have moisture, you know, water control, you don't have hedgerows, all of a sudden, you know, that what used to be 8 to 15 feet of topsoil in Indiana is now 5 feet of topsoil. And it's all gone into the Mississippi and gone down to, you know, Louisiana, to New Orleans and out into the bay. So again, being encouraging of practices that hold on to the current status, but also providing technical assistance from the USDA that actually allows people to plan for and mitigate for anticipated, you know, disruptions. So cultivating moisture in a dry year and holding on to moisture in a wet year so that you're able to continue growing. A lot of our growers in Vermont actually just got flooded out in the last 2 weeks with the rains and the events up there. And even those who had sort of light flooding, if there's any sort of food safety risk, you know, sewage plant upstream of you, your plants now are not saleable. And we don't have risk management mechanisms there to subsidize them to survive those sorts of crises either. So there's, like I said, there's both economic hedges and there's also environmental and site-based hedges. Like I said, some of these are mitigation strategies. So buffers and retention ponds and things like that can be really helpful to mitigate effects without actually, you know, changing them day to day. And then there's adaptation strategies. We talked about seeds, having a bank of seeds that's actually responsive to the emerging conditions in your area. Something for low moisture, something for high moisture and high disease, something for in between. And making sure that those also harken back to cultural legacies that people are actually able to access. You know, just because you grow a crop doesn't mean your customers want it, understand it, or have a framework in their culture to assimilate it. So you need to have a bank of diverse crops to be able to be responsive to that. Let me see here. So in the last sort of section here, I wanted to talk a little bit about food security and what that, how we think about that, and how it relates to agriculture. So I use the UN Food and Ag Organization's definition that food security exists when all people at all times have physical and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food that meets their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life. So there's a lot in there. Yeah. a lot. Yeah, sure. I'm happy to repeat. So food security exists when all people at all times have physical and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food that meets their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life. Yes, we are a long ways from that. And they break that out into sort of four dimensions that I think are also instructive and sort of we've touched on some of these already and I think are worth considering. The first is the physical availability of food, that it be grown, that it be proximate, that it be available, right? But that's not enough. It needs to be economically and physically available to that person. They have to be able to afford it and it has to be near to them, not just in the rough area. They also have to have the sufficient energy to utilize and assimilate and uptake those nutrients. You know, their biologic function, whether it be compromised by stress or by, you know, other elements of their environment, if they're not actually able to utilize that food that they've taken in, again, it's not meaningful. And then the stability of those three dimensions over time, you need to make sure that there's a consistent expectation that you're able to meet those previous three needs. And that's something too, where, you know, you think about the price shocks, supply shocks, some of this is going to threaten many of us in the next 25 years. And so I think having both the broad definition and having those dimensions in mind is really, really illustrative.
I think you're far enough along that I can ask this question.
Sure.
Because I think you're getting ready to wrap up here.
Sure.
Okay. Why are you doing this? I'd like you to tell me, this is the softball question of all softball questions.
Sure.
What gets you up in the morning? What makes you do this? And if you had more of a forum through which to deliver your message, you know, I don't know if you're the only voice crying in the wilderness out there, or if there are thousands of people saying what you're saying. Help me with that whole engine, why you're there and what you're doing and what do you really care about here?
Yeah. So I come to this fundamentally from an education background and from an international development background. That's what I did my academic work on, and realized part of the way through that agriculture, when you ask questions about, you know, broad global sustainability, and when you think about the way that it interfaces with lives and livelihoods, the answer to me kept coming back to agriculture and sustainable agriculture. You know, whether you're talking about energy production, you know, food commodities, food products, you know, all of that, but also the community element of it. It just sort of everything sort of anchored back in some way to that. And so I sort of decided to move along in that space. The thing that keeps me in it is the growers themselves. They are, you know, the best teachers. They are the most attuned researchers. They're the most thoughtful, even in moments of, you know, great hardship and stress, both reflecting sort of, you know, I think they reflect our society back to us, and they also sort of highlight the way forward. And just incredibly generous, you know, with their time and their knowledge. There isn't knowledge hoarding. There isn't selfishness in that way. There might be blind spots. There might be a lack of capacity to engage, but it's never for lack of a desire to engage or to share. So yeah, that's sort of what keeps me in it. And then to see, you know, as they live those values and as they share that information out, to see the virtuous cycles sort of reveal themselves. And it's sort of like teaching. I don't know if anybody's been a teacher of any kind, but you know, you get all the complaints up front, you know, in your quarterly review, in your annual review, whatever, but the positive feedback and the meaningful impact, you only hear about 5, 7, 10 years later from somebody who went out into the world and says, that thing you said was really helpful, or that thing that we did together was really meaningful, or showed me the way forward. So that's the other thing, is just sort of the positive feedback that you see in those spaces. Yeah. Yeah.
Hi, I'd like to ask, have you been to any seminars, or do you, amongst your peers? I'm pretty concerned about the big picture. It's like one of those things about me, like since 68, I've been big picture. Uh-huh. So when, you know, you hear about Ukraine's a breadbasket for so many countries, when you hear that California's had so many drought years that they lost all their groundwater.
Yeah.
When you hear, like, even last year, I saw an interview with a husband and wife were like fourth generation farmers, big farmers, like in, I'm just going to say Kansas, I'm not sure where. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, we have only 30% production, nothing's growing, we're getting dust storms.
Yep.
And then you put this year on top of it, where you look at a map and the whole thing's red with 100 degrees.
Yeah.
And plus, I've gone hunting with my dad when he was alive, going to game commission farms in Pennsylvania. And my dad was saying to a commissioner, oh, good, somebody else left their farm for the hunters. Isn't that great? And the commissioner goes, no, we can't get taxes from that farm now.
Right.
And I'm thinking of our family. One family was in dairy for four generations. The generation my age, they didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
It's too much commitment.
Yeah.
So when you look at what maybe if you can't farm out west anymore, we better start farming in Pennsylvania again. What do you see a trend, or am I too much of a too worried for shouldn't be worried? You know, I like the idea of letting the farms be quartered and meadow for X number of years. So, I mean, we have to keep the ground healthy, and who's going to be feeding the next generation? What's the next 100 years? Who's going to be feeding the world?
Yep. Well, that set me up for one of my closing points. So thank you for that. I think that there's a lot of really instructive details in your question there. I'll try to hit as much of that as I can. I think, and you asked earlier, and I think that this is what brings it all back around, is that we need to start finding ways to both think and act and operate beyond the political boundaries that we've set. I sit on the County Farmland Preservation Board. And so farmland preservation is funded by a property transfer tax. So with the property values in Allegheny County and the number of transfers of people coming in and all of that and the development, we have 3 to 4 to 5 times more farmland preservation budget than any of our peers. Our farmland is also more expensive, right? But there's very little left to be preserved in a meaningful way. So there's two things. One, we have to reimagine what farmland preservation looks like to get to smaller parcels or to be able to subdivide larger parcels for multiple growers. Keep it in agriculture, but make it accessible to folks who have more intensive production goals or a smaller scale goals, things like that. Because 150 acres is a big bite unless you're in dairy or something like that. Maybe that's 3 or 4 smaller parcels for diversified growers, things like that. It's also true, though, that there's a lot of idle farmland in all of the contiguous counties, and it's all being sort of made available by handshake deals within local communities for basically the value of the tax dollars, $50 an acre, $100 an acre, just to pay the taxes, and just sort of generally, it's just idle. It's being farmed kind of, but it's not being used to any high function, and it's not being made available to anyone. The operators are almost as old as the owners. And so I think realizing that those realities are there and encouraging just updating policies and supporting things that are advantageous to new and beginning growers to be able to get in. There's so much friction to get into farming as a career that basically, like I said, we're idling the vast majority of people who might be interested in pursuing it. We're also, you know, making really high barriers, even if you are able to access it. You know, like the infrastructure has broken down on those farms. So now you're on the hook for a loan or to fundraise for all of the budget to start a farm. So it's not just that you're getting a barn and equipment and you're starting, you have to buy or build all of that too. There's no easy solutions, but I don't think anything is insurmountable either. I think that it's a lot of small tweaks along the way. One of the things that we haven't talked about here is just thinking about ourselves in terms of food sheds rather than our distinct political boundaries. So if you think about your home borough and you draw 150-mile radius around it, that's your food shed most likely. And that's your local food. And then 150 miles beyond that is your regional food. And then you get to your national food, and then you get to your international food. Thinking in terms of those concentric and overlapping circles, as far as, you know, you want to support new farms and farm capacity and farm resilience, not just for, what is this, Upper St. Clair? I don't know what borough we are, Upper St. Clair. You know, you want to think about it too for like Findlay and Charleroi, and you want to think about it for Butler, and you want to think about it for Beaver, you know, because that's your food shed. And if you think about it, if you draw that 150-mile radius, that puts you out in the Chesapeake Bay. So we should be concerned, even though it's not our watershed, should be concerned for the Chesapeake Bay because that's our closest local seafood, right? So we need to be thinking sort of beyond those boundaries and sort of working in those ways. Okay.
Are you optimistic? about all this?
Yeah, I have about 3 down days a year. Like I said, the slack in the system, the capacity that hasn't been tapped, and all of the opportunities that are yet to be taken up, that's what makes me optimistic. If I felt like we had burned through all of our options and that we had, you know, mobilized all of these practices and all of our young people and all of that and gotten, you know, all of this stuff, if we had gotten to the end point of all of that and it still wasn't working, I probably might get a little bit down about it. But there is like such a gulf between the opportunities and the possibilities to bridge the need that I think it's just a matter of, you know, the time of putting in the effort and the focus and supporting the people. Like all of us have, you know, small little bits to play, you know, supporting our local farmers, you know, being customers, CSA members and all of that. Yeah, we're at time. But thinking about, you know, yourselves as part of a larger food system, food shed, in the same way that we think about watersheds, I think is the way forward. I also think dialoguing with your growers, you know, market is probably not the time to be chatting them up about big policy issues, especially in July and August. I know farmers hate that. But finding other opportunities to invite them into forums like this, to dialogue in the off season and all of that, and understand what the forces are on them and what they see as the way forward. So I'm sort of aggregating a lot of perspective here, but hearing from them individually, I think would be a really instructive next step for y'all. So thanks.
Well, I just want to say thank you. I know I learned a lot, so let's thank them.